You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Kelly Yang, the author of past book club pick Front Desk, among just a ton of really great middle grade and young adult novels. We chat with her about her adult novel debut, The Take, a novel about an aspiring Chinese American novelist who gets the opportunity of a lifetime to break into the entertainment industry. And all she needs to do is just trade a little bit of her youth to a veteran movie producer. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server. We can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick. As always, thanks to everyone who has joined us on Patreon, and we hope to see a lot more of you there in the future.
Yeah, so we talked to Kelly about her journey from writing Front Desk, a middle grade novel, to now her debut adult novel, The Take. We talked about ageism. We talked about intersectionality. We talked about the cutthroat competition in creative fields and how that plays into power dynamics between younger and older women. It's a very, like, I would say it was like a pretty deep conversation. So I hope you guys enjoy it. And we are here with Kelly Yang, the number one New York Times bestselling author of the Front Desk series and young adult novels Parachutes and Private Label. She is the recipient of the 2019 APA LA Award for Children's Literature, and her books have been named one of the best books of the 21st century by Kirkus. In addition to being a novelist, she has written screenplays and television pilots for Netflix, CBS Studios, and the CW. And we are here to talk to her about her debut adult novel, The Take. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm such a huge fan of your show.
Well, we're a big fan of your books. I'm so glad we finally were able to sync our schedules together for this chat. I'm really excited. We usually begin our chats with a little icebreaker. And my icebreaker to you is, if you could greenlight any screen adaptation of a book that's not yours, what book would it be?
Ooh. Well, I recently read and loved Stacey Lee's Kill Her Twice. It is set in LA in the 1930s, and it is about Chinatown. It is about what they were trying to do to Chinatown at the time, which was to move it and really like dismantle it. And it's a really great page turner, and I loved it. So I would greenlight that one.
Yeah, we read that for a book club too. I think what's the year?
Oh,
ago?
Good.
I feel like Stacey Lee's books fit really well with the film medium because a lot of them
yes.
are like period pieces, and I'm like, I would love to see like Downstairs Girl.
Yes.
Like you see that cover of like this Asian American woman dressed in like Southern Belle style. I'm like, oh my god, I would love to see that. I mean, we have the Gilded Age, so we should definitely be able
we
to
should have that.
Like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say like many of her books should be.
And like 1930s, adapted. 1940s LA is just a really cool like aesthetic time. Like it reminds me of 1920s Shanghai. Just everyone's wearing suits. Everyone's just looking real good.
Yeah. It would look so good.
Yeah.
For me, I would love to see Jessie Q. Sutanto's Dial A for Aunties, which is kind of like a Weekend
best.
At Bernie's type of story. And I'm like, I think it is time to bring back that story. And also we love our aunties. They're crazy. They drive us nuts and they're so resourceful. And who doesn't love seeing a wedding in a movie? It's like, I love seeing weddings in movies because the production level is like so high end. So I think it would be really fun to see that on screen.
And she's also just such a cool person. Jessie's just an amazing person.
She's very funny.
She's cool.
Yeah. I think, you know, the thing is like there are so many really great books that we've read that a lot of them got the option to be turned into a series and options. Just didn't move forward. I think Dal A got like option at one point. I know her Vera Wang, Unsolicited Guide to Murderers was also optioned like a couple years ago. One thing that was in the pipe that I think is no longer moving forward because it got stuck in development hell was Fonda Lee's Jade City. And that's still a book that I would love to see adapted because I just think it's just real cool.
Yeah, it's really too bad that so many of these projects, you know, they do get optioned, but they don't really move forward. I think it's really like it's infuriating.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing about like people who are not familiar with Hollywood, they don't understand how like optioning works. Like just because something got optioned doesn't mean that it's guaranteed development, guaranteed, a green light. And even if it does get made, it's like, oh, they can always shelve it at the end. So, it's a long process. Oh, you know, process.
Another one I would do New Kid by my friend Jerry Craft.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So many books that I would love to see on screen. It's really terrible that right now it's just like the age of like sequels and reboots. And it's just like, I mean, your book kind of goes into that.
Where, frankly, like it's the age of where we're sort of rolling back on a lot of the diverse movies and diverse shows, diversity in general. I think that is something that like is the elephant in the room, but
but let's move on to like, you know, your author journey. You based your debut novel Front Desk on your own childhood experience of working the front desk at a motel that your parents managed. Can you just walk me through like what compelled you to become an author and to turn that experience into your first novel?
Totally. So the thing that compelled me was my son, Elliot, was 8 years old at the time, and he wasn't reading. He hadn't found the perfect book yet. He wanted a book that was easy to read, but felt important, like he was learning something, but that it was still really, really easy to read. And so as a teacher at the time, I thought, oh my gosh, I need to deliver. Like, I can't fail him in this regard. And at the same time, he didn't know how he grew up. So I thought, why not tell him in the form of a book? You know, I would write a chapter a day and we would read it together. And at the end of the summer, I kind of had a first draft. Now, it was not a great first draft, to be fair, but it was enough for me to sort of start the publishing journey. He was very insistent that I try to get it published, to get an agent. I, of course, had no idea how to do that. But yeah, I just sort of, you know, leaned in and tried to give it a shot. And here I am.
Yeah, you've had, I would say, a prolific career since then, writing so many books, you know, middle grade, young adult, and now adult. I did want to ask, like, speaking of Front Desk, I did want to get your thoughts about, like, what has become, like, our ongoing societal battle against book banning, because, you know, your book, Front Desk, was inexplicably thrust into the book banning discussion when someone took offense to, like, a scene in your book, right? And, you know, we read Front Desk for a book club, and I spent the whole time thinking, like, how could this book be, like, that offensive? Like, it's just like, you know, there's plenty of coverage our listeners can find out there about the book and how you address that. But I want to ask, like, if those experiences of, like, fighting the book bans and your book going through that, has it had any effect on the way that you approach the stories that you write now? Like, how has that, like, energized or affected the way that you approach the stories that you tell?
I mean, it's really draining. It's like a terrible, terrible experience. You know, I think after a while, it just sucks a lot of that creative energy out because it's already really, really hard to put yourself on the page. And so many of these stories like didn't exist when we were growing up. You know, we think about all the kids out there who feel seen by them. So the fact that like some people, very small, I would say a very small select minority group of people, very, very, very few people, but still they're very loud and they say, okay, well, I don't think it should be read. It takes the wind out of you as an author. And for a little while, I was kind of like depressed. I wasn't really feeling excited about writing for a little while. And that is one of the reasons why I wanted something fresh. And I wanted myself to take on a fresh new project and hopefully get re-energized again. And that was for me writing my adult novel. But yeah, I would, oh my God, that whole thing, the whole situation with book banning is, it's demoralizing. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we do our news episodes every month, and I feel like I see something about book banning every month. And it is like really disheartening. However, I do love like our librarians and teachers who are really stepping up, and the parents who are saying, this is not okay. Like, media literacy is critical. And just because someone is not cis, straight, white doesn't mean that, you know, they should be banned from being in stories. And
right.
Yeah, it's quite a burden to put on creators when, you know, their job is to create and not, you know, mitigate all of this, all of these issues that are happening outside of their desk. I do want to go back a little in time. So you went to college at 13 and you went to UC Berkeley and Harvard Law School. I'm guessing that this is a very different childhood from the rest of us. Not a lot of us go to higher education at that young of an age. And I'm just curious as to like how, like, was writing always part of your plan, even from that age? And how did you like get there in terms of like, okay, this is a profession, I can pivot to this?
Yeah. Well, writing was always the thing that got me through any situation, like got me through, you know, poverty, or got me through like horrible things that have happened in my life, or just like feeling like I don't really know how to keep going from whatever situation. My parents would get, you know, would move a lot, or a lot of instability happened in my childhood, and writing kind of got me through them. In terms of when I wanted to be a writer, I think I've always wanted to be a writer. I've always been the storyteller, you know, and I think I got it from my parents. They're both like really into telling their stories at dinner, like, let me tell you what happened today, blah, blah, blah. You know, I come from a big family of people like that. And I wanted to do it, but I wasn't sure if I could, because all the books that I picked up at school, in the library, you know, when I flipped to the back, the people on the back did not look like me. And so I wasn't sure whether this was a viable path. And it really wasn't until Front Desk kind of took off that I realized, actually, I can do this. I can keep writing.
Yeah, I mean, as book club podcast for Asian and Asian American authors, your books pop up every once in a while. Like every few months, there's a new Kelly Yang book out that we're seeing an announcement for. And so, you know, you've written a lot of books for young readers, for adolescents, and now for adults. I'm curious, what are some of the insights you've gained about like the Asian American story? And now that you've debuted your first adult novel, like what are some themes that writing for an adult audience allows you to explore that you couldn't before when you wrote for younger audiences?
Wow, this is such a great question. Okay, so first of all, there's not one Asian American story. I think that's the biggest, most important thing that all of us need to understand. There's so many great stories out there. You know, we're not a monolith. We have so many different people that make up, you know, Asian American, Asian Pacific American. And honestly, there's just so much to explore and unpack. And I love that I got to write a story about two really kind of unhinged women. They're like, they're messy, they're complicated. I didn't get pigeonholed into writing, you know, the immigrant story. And that's something that was important to me, because I have written great immigrant stories too, but I didn't want to just only be allowed to write one kind of story. So that was something that I've learned as well. Just like, if there's something you want to do, you know, really advocating for it and not letting people tell you who to be in this world.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue to get into talking about your newest novel, The Take. For our listeners who may not be familiar with your newest novel, can you let us know like the basic like synopsis/elevator pitch for what The Take is about?
Okay, so The Take is about two women who are both tired of being judged for their age. One is in her 50s. She's a white Hollywood producer. She's 53, and she is sort of being told that her time is up in the studio, right? She's kind of getting sidelined. Like, people are starting to say, you know, you're not really relevant anymore. There are younger people coming up. And she's not happy about being told that. And she actually decides to embark on this really experimental anti-aging treatment that her doctor introduces her to, where she can age back 10 years, but only if she recruits a younger woman to do it with us, to do this with. And she does. She recruits Maggie Wayne, who is a 23-year-old Asian American struggling writer who sees this as an opportunity for her to get some mentorship from Ingrid, also get $3 million. But the catch is that she has to age forward about 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's as dystopic as you can get when it comes to healthcare. It's like, oh, you're desperate enough to sell your youth for $3 million and thinking that it's a bargain. I wanted to ask, so the idea of an older person taking the blood of a younger person to continue their longevity. This isn't something new. We have like the legend of Elizabeth Bathory, who bathed in the blood of young servant girls, which turned out to be completely false. And then you have now with like Brian Johnson, who is like the multi-millionaire who is obsessed with anti-aging. Like he's the one who had like a procedure where he took plasma from his 17-year-old son. So like, can you talk about like your inspiration for like this procedure?
Okay, so my inspiration was I was reading an article in the New York Times about a new medical procedure that they figured out on mice, where they have figured out how to get older mice to de-age by joining them effectively with younger mice. And it's a little more complicated than a blood transfusion, but essentially it's kind of a similar concept where they're going to infuse the older mice with the younger mice's blood and all of the, you know, try to reverse some of the mutations that are in the older mice's blood, which are causing a lot of the medical problems that the older mice is having. And they figured out that it works, that the older mice gets younger and all the health problems start to disappear. But unfortunately, the younger mice, they start inhibiting some of the health problems and they start getting a little bit older. And so when I read that article, I was like immediately going, oh my God, it is only a matter of time before they figure out how to do this with humans. And also like, what is that going to look like? You know, what does it feel like to sit there with someone, spend so much time together because they're getting to know each other. So many of the sessions, the women really do open up to each other. You know, they really get vulnerable about what it is, what aging is like. But at the same time, the thing that is happening is one of them is taking from the other person in this truly horrifying way.
Yeah, there's so many themes that like are in your book, and so many like the concept of like, yeah, for a young person without experience, what they have of most value is their youth. But at the same time, like the people with experience, the youth, their age becomes like a liability, right? And it's you know, even as a dude, I can relate to, or I can empathize, I guess the right word. But like,
yeah,
if a dude did this procedure, dudes have been doing this procedure, right? We've been seeing
all these I mean only dudes have been doing this procedure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not for women doing any of this.
It's kind of like in entertainment and in society, I guess, in general, like there's so many factors that go into judging women that men don't have to deal with, right? And by applying this like de-aging technology to women, it's like it opens up so many like interesting themes to explore in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's just crazy how far we've gone with the anti-aging craze as a society. It's gone way too far. But also with biohacking, it's like, where is the limit? You know, if people have the means, and I've talked to a number of young people, like I've been interviewing people at the park and at coffee shops. So many young people really feel like their dreams are unaffordable. And if something like this were to happen and exist, I could see a lot of young people saying, yeah, I want to do it. $3 million is life-changing. I want to sign up. I personally myself might have signed up. You know, I wanted so badly to be a writer, but as my parents constantly reminded me, writing is extremely unstable. It's financially unstable, and they're right. It is. So if someone had come along and given me $3 million in exchange, I just aged 10 years, I probably would have taken it because I would have thought, okay, now I can jumpstart my life.
Yeah, I think that part of Maggie's story also resonated with me as, like, you know, through this podcast, we've talked to countless authors, and a lot of them as Asian Americans have talked about how, like, they didn't have anyone to model their, like, their dreams on, right? There was no, you know, like you mentioned, there were not a lot of Asian Americans in the industry to, like, model or show the way. So I thought that was really, like, you know, the Maggie chapters are very, like, it was as an Asian American, as a Chinese American, I definitely related to just the fact that, like, even their relationship with their parents, like, being torn between pursuing her dream and living to up to her family obligations, and you know, how even that relationship can be seen, at least in her head, as transactional, right? Like, I'm not living up to my end of the bargain after what my parents did for me, and what that does to Maggie, and what that, how that leads to her making decisions as she does.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I would say the other thing is just, like, her feeling like the book starts with her trying to get the approval and advice of another Asian American writer, someone who is very well established and she admires greatly. And that woman basically says, what do you have to write about in your 20s? But basically tells her, like, don't, you know, don't get in my lane, girl. And I, first of all, like, that's the most crushing feeling, I think, when you have another woman of color disappoint you that way and tell you that maybe you shouldn't be doing this, or maybe you shouldn't try to compete. I think that is, I've had that experience myself a few times, and every time it hurts, like, in a very special way.
Like, I was going to ask you about that scene where Estelle tells Maggie that you don't have enough life experience. You're too young to write a good novel. And I thought that was, like, really interesting to read from, like, a publishing lens, because I feel like so many publishers now, they are going after young debut novelists who can be the next big thing. They're investing a lot of time and energy into that. And then they're also investing their time and energy into established authors who have, like, 5-6 critical hits under their belt. But then in the middle, it's like, fight for yourself. Like, it is.
Like,
there is, like, no, basically, like, no support. So I just want to, like, ask you about your observations that you've made about how the publishing industry factors in age in their authors, especially since, you know, you have a very unique perspective on age, considering that you went to college so early in life. I'm sure you have thoughts on, like, how age can be perceived as naivety or authority, depending on how old or young you are.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the experience from both ends. I remember being in my 20s and wanting to write front desk, which truly was a story I've had in me since I was 8 years old. I mean, arguably could have written it any time past eight. But having, you know, people tell me, including other novelists, that I was too young, that I really needed to wait my turn, that I didn't have enough life experience yet. In hindsight, that those were kind of mean comments. They weren't great for me. I mean, I don't know if they were meant to be mean, but they were definitely taken in a pretty hurtful way. So I've had that experience. And then where I started, I mean, as a children's book author, I think the further away you get from being 12, the more you worry, am I getting too old? Like, do I really still know my audience? And this really, it really flared up in my mind, especially when I was writing young adult YA stuff, when I noticed that the publishers really cared and loved the people who were really great with TikTok. And I'll be honest, I'm a 41-year-old. You know, there's only so much I can do. And I do try to do a lot of social media, and I love my Instagram, but I am not a TikToker, nor will I ever be one. I am not good at a lot of the different platforms. And it was that sort of feeling like, because I'm not this young, cool thing on TikTok, does that mean I'm not going to be supported? Or what does that mean for me, basically? You know, and I had that feeling that Ingrid had, which is like, oh God, like, after all the stuff I've done, it's just, it can all just be wiped out in a second.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like you said earlier that it is heartbreaking when another author of color says, like, oh, you don't have enough experience, like, it is really disheartening, even if it might not be, you know, intentionally harmful. But as we've seen with Ingrid, like many women and marginalized creators, especially from the previous gen, can feel jealous of the up and coming mm-hmm. generation of creators. And yeah. they can gatekeep this power that they fought tooth and nail for because, you know, they endured so much. And the thing about like paving the way for people is that the path will be smoother after, mm-hmm. you know, after you go down it. So obviously the people behind you are going to have an easier time. But I think right. that can build up a lot of resentment. So I just want to hear your thoughts on like this culture of quote unquote paying your dues yeah. in like the creative fields. I'm like, what does that even mean nowadays?
Oh my gosh. And we get into this conversation all the time. And it's this idea that if you haven't sufficiently endured, or really let's face it, let's call it suffering, right? If you haven't sufficiently suffered, that you're lesser for it, that you're not as qualified, or that why should your path be easier, right? Why should you have an easier time? I had it this way, so therefore, you know, you should have it this way too. And there's also the idea, I'm back to what you're saying about, you know, women of color, and it's I think we're getting a lot better at it. I think it's gotten a lot better. But it is almost like we bought into this idea that the pie is only so big for those of us who are not white. And that's a very flawed way of thinking. I don't agree with it. I think that we're actively making the pie bigger. But we also look at the statistics and, you know, by and large, right, white creators are just able to command so much more money and so much more support and all these other things. So over time, I don't know if it's like some people internalize that, but it does create this sense of like it's a zero sum game, which again, I don't think is right.
Yeah, I feel like it's also comes from like in order to make it in like their generation, they had to play the man's game. They had to be, you know, they had to be better than the men. And because of that, there's this like ingrained, again, yeah, like you mentioned, this ingrained competitiveness that's like you need to succeed in this specific way that I did, or else you don't have what it takes. Whereas I think these days, you know, we've developed the language to expand the pie instead of like gatekeep the pie. Although we still I don't think we're there yet, but definitely I think more people, at least in the up and coming, like our generation, like I'm 42 years old as well. Like we're millennials, but we're like also like middle aged now. You know?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? I know. Yeah.
But I feel like we have a better grasp of like the language and the concepts of like everyone can succeed if we all just like kind of help each other out. Like that's probably a better way in the long run.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a line from the book, which is there's only two ways to get ahead in the world. You either make something or take something. And of course, Ingrid says that. But I think that there's a third way, like we can give something. And I think that, you know, we do it in our own little way all the time. But we just need to, you know, I think those of us who are coming up, we need to find those people who are the givers.
Yeah. I mean, speak of Ingrid, you know, the marketing of your novel makes reference to R.F. Kuang's Yellow Face, and you could definitely see like a through line with Ingrid's character and like kind of the unhinged things that she does and says and thinks. Can you talk to us about like the experience of like writing a white character with the sheer amounts of like mental gymnastics she needs to go through to justify the things that she does in this novel? Like, was it fun to get in the head of like Ingrid's head and like write about some white drama for once?
It was fun. It was super fun. I think it was fun because I know a lot of Ingrids, you know? And so I could totally get into that, like, but we're trying to make the world better, you know, headspace. And to kind of like, it was comical. It was satire. It was sort of making fun of some of the things. But also the thing that surprised me was I did in different parts really relate to Ingrid. You know, I have three kids. I am constantly frustrated with what I perceive is like lack of, you know, as much hard work as I put in at their age or whatever, you know, just this constant, you know, generational divide. I did relate a lot to Ingrid, I have to say. And that was the thing that was surprising to me.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat there. Like I'm nowhere near the same age as like Ingrid, but like, you know, just like I could feel for her because like she really did fight tooth and nail to get a seat at like the boys club table, in especially mm-hmm. in Hollywood, where it's like there's an expiration date on women. And that's not even for actors. It's like for producers, for writers, for even like PAs. Like there is like a serious ageism problem in Hollywood. So 100%. Like I could like really sympathize. And also, you know, it's not great when the only way people want to like hang out with you is so that they can use you. And that's not healthy at all. And whether you're in Hollywood or not, it's like there are people like that who will always take advantage of your goodwill. Not saying that Ingrid is like a good person, but you can understand like that, you know, wariness, that fatigueness, because it's like you have worked so hard and you know, people are only seeing you as a gateway to something rather than like a person. So I do feel for Ingrid. Does that make does that make me an old person?
No, I think it makes us
That's what makes her chapter so interesting, because she's so close. She's so close to getting it like right, quote unquote right, but also she can't get out of her own way. She's very selfish, and she's like, you know, at the end of the day, she is stealing someone's youth to like prolong her own like career. And that is, you know, that's vampire.
This is stuff, why right? white feminism is not enough. You know, that's why intersectionality means so much. It's like white feminism only helps you, but if it doesn't like help the other people, you know, like it's just like, what are we doing? You can tell yourself that you're doing it for the greater good, but you're only doing it because it benefits you in the end.
I think that's what I kind of was frustrating, was, you know, kind of this sentiment of like, well, we can only achieve this much because it's enough. Like, this is it. We can't be greedy. We can't ask for more. This is what we're going to get right now. And then the rest of us are like, okay, but where does that leave us? You know?
Yeah. In her chapter, she's such an unreliable narrator. So it was fun to have like Maggie's chapters, not only as a palate cleanser, like Maggie's chapters were messy in its own right, but it was, compared to the mess of Ingrid's chapter, it was like, oh, it's like a little refreshing to get back to like the Asian American struggles. But, you know, her perspective also gives us a chance to see Ingrid's actions as they really are. It's like, oh, you know, like you've developed this narrative of like you as like this white savior, this like feminist warrior. But in the end, you're also just like a really controlling boss, and that's not cool either.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I remember in my youth, like really always thinking that some white lady was going to come along and save my life. I mean, a lot of those, that thread about Maggie and the lady at church, that was pulled from my own childhood. My mom sent me to go hang out with this random lady and her granddaughter. I was supposed to babysit her. And I remember like at first just being okay, like now my whole life's gonna be better because I'll get to eat at Denny's. This is great. You know, and then slowly like descending into complete chaos, to the point where then I was like, I don't know how to get back home. I need to get home. Like, this is worse than I need to go home. Like, this is not my life, and I'm getting completely exploited here. Like, there's free babysitting, we're hardly ever going to Denny's. You know.
I think you explore like that, I guess like ingenue, like hope of like, okay, someone is going to give me that chance. Someone is going to quote unquote save me. And, you know, like in creative fields, like we desperately need mentors, but I feel like we need to emphasize that you cannot wait for a mentor to give you like the golden ticket to whatever industry you're trying to like put your foot in the door for, because honestly, I say this as like as a writer, so like I resonated a lot with Maggie and also like Ingrid, but it's just you can't wait for permission to write your story, and you can't wait for the right conditions because you don't know what those right conditions are. And you know, in your book, like Ingrid and Maggie, they trade more than blood. Like, they're spending a lot of time together, like you said earlier. And Ingrid uses Maggie's writing and childhood experiences to keep her career relevant, to keep this movie based on, like, her favorite book, like, still, like, to keep it afloat. And then Maggie uses Ingrid's proximity to white power to become a professional writer. And I think a recurring theme in your book is, what should you take and not take from other people's experiences to use for your own material? And I just want to hear your stance on, like, as a writer, like, what is that thin line between borrowing and appropriation? Like, how do we walk that line as writers?
Wow. Oh my God, that's such a great question. And, like, literally preached everything you're saying about, you know, wanting to be saved and not at the same time learning the hard way that you can't wait for that golden ticket. You're absolutely 100% right. So the way I look at it is, I think that you have to really try hard to understand your own experience and not just try to, like, leech onto someone else's experience. There are so many times where that feels easier and seems like a better path. But in fact, your own experience is the story that only you can tell. So if there's something that only you can tell, that's always the better path, right? Because you're going to be able to tell it better. It's going to help you understand everything that happened and make you understand other people as well. So, I mean, like, for me, that's kind of my golden rule, is I don't want to leech onto someone else's experience. I want, even if I'm writing Ingrid, I'm trying to, like, use that narrative to really, it's as a vehicle to really unpack things that I want to unpack in the story, right? The times in my life where I felt like you said, you know, just waiting for that golden ticket, you know, doing everything I can. So in that sense, I think that there is a really big line between taking inspiration from things that happened. You know, maybe you read something, like I read about the mice, and then your mind takes that in a totally different direction and completely appropriating, especially someone else's experience that's not yours, you know, that you don't really, you're not the right person to tell the story. I guess that's the main, that's how you can determine it, is, are you the right person to tell the story?
Yeah. And I think that question is, it's not easy to answer at, like, for all projects. But, like, this, it does, like, make me laugh when I think about how actors, they have, like, method acting, and then there's method writing for some writers, where they have to, like, live that experience to, like, write whatever happened in their life in their book. And you show it really well through Bryce, who is Maggie's ex. I just thought he was, like, such a funny character. Like, was he in the book in, like, from the very beginning of your planning?
From the very beginning. I thought he was, like, because he's an infuriating, he's also, like, you know, Maggie's age, but he gets so many things pushed through because he's a guy, he's also rich, you know, so it's this feeling of, like, I'm being measured up against other people who are more experienced, but also getting measured up against people who are just more privileged, who are my same age, but they did not start out where I started. And just feeling, oh God, how am I gonna get anywhere?
Yeah, I think you portrayed, like, I don't know, that, like, jealousy and anxiety of, like, having your peers get ahead in their career. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you are happy for them. Mm-hmm. However, it's really hard when
you're waiting
for your own opportunity and you're like, oh, like, when is it going to be my turn? Why am I not good enough? And I think with Bryce, I thought that was, like, a really good example of, like, hey, publishing, like, MFA programs, it requires a lot of money and time.
Yeah.
Like, it's not so much, like, talent. It's about, like, time, money, access, and also like whatever the publishing houses are looking for, because they're always looking for, like, the next hot thing. So I just thought that Bryce and the whole, like, MFA group of friends was, like, very, like, I don't know. It's like very relatable. I'm like, oh, this is like your 20s group. This is this is when everybody totally. Is at. Everyone has gone started at the same starting line, essentially, like the MFA program, and then everybody just like goes into different directions. And
I feel like especially with creative fields, like we don't talk about how people are making it work, you know. And there's a lot of like family money involved, frankly, sometimes. But it can feel like if you don't really talk about the financial aspect, you can feel like, why are they able to make it work and I'm not? Like, what's wrong with me?
And, you know, as I was reading your book, I also thought, like, man, this is a very, like, Maggie is a very, she felt like one of your middle grade characters, but growing up into adult, right? Like, she faces very similar challenges, especially with her parents and her, you know, the classic Asian American story of dreams versus responsibilities, right? How was the experience of like creating your main character for adult audiences, and how did it differ from, you know, writing for younger audiences?
Oh, well, I just sort of threw myself into this project without really overthinking it, you know. A lot of times when I start out, you know, especially if you've written a bunch of books, you start overthinking things. You're like, oh, I've kind of done this before, or, you know, is this person too much like this other character? And it's hard to feel that freshness. With this book, it was all freshness. Everything was fresh, and they just made ridiculous decisions from day one, like literally from the first page. And I was able to give myself that freedom to write all their thoughts. I mean, all their furies. They had so many grievances with the world, and I could really lean into all of that. I think that was the thing that was fun too, was just writing a more morally gray character versus in middle grade, I think we are usually writing someone you want to root for. And here it's like unclear because they both do really dumbass things.
Yeah, but they're also young. I mean, as a 43-year-old, like these are kids. Like they're still figuring it out too, right? But I did relate to the you know, it's a special occasion. We're doing something dumb. Let's drink the expensive alcohol, right? Let's just pull that out.
So we're winding down to like our end of our chat, and it's been such like a great chat. Like you blink and it's like almost over. I'd be remiss to ask, do you have another book that you're working on right now, or are you like focusing more on the promotions for this book?
Yeah, I actually am trying to write another middle grade. Working on that. Yay! And then I'm also trying to figure out my next adult book. I wrote a draft and I'm not sure that it's going to work. I don't know. So we'll see. You know, that's just the brutal truth of being in the industry. It's like, you know, after many, many, many books, you still, every single book, you wonder, do I really know how to do this? It's the question that never goes away.
I mean, a Kelly Yang speculative fiction adult novel was not on my view card from coming out. So
yeah, let me just say, I was very surprised when saw the like the publicist like statement on it. I was like, oh, this sounds really cool. Who wrote it? Kelly Yang, the author of Front Desk. Like, okay. That's very interesting. I mean, very new. And I'm really glad that you took the plunge, because it was such a great book. I really enjoyed reading it.
Yeah,
it was different. It was very different. And I think that's the fun thing. It's like, you know, we gotta do whatever we want. Like, just again, don't let them pigeonhole you.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on your adult debut, and good luck on all your future endeavors. We're very much looking forward to hearing more from you in the future. But glad to finally have you on Books and Boba. And yeah.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun. And I had such a great time. We had an amazing, very rich conversation. And I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It was lovely having you as well.
And that was Kelly Yang. Her latest novel, The Take, is available now at bookstores everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookshop, where all purchases help to support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstore. So definitely appreciate everyone who has bought a book from us on our online bookstore. You can reach it by going to booksandboba.com and checking out our bookshop link. All right, before we go, Rira, can you remind us what our book club pick is for the month of April 2026?
Yeah, so we're reading The Elsewhere Express by Samantha Soto Yambao, and it is a fantasy novel about a magical train that appears to people who feel lost and, you know, kind of offers them a chance to find peace and purpose.
Yeah, this was our latest patron's choice. So like we mentioned at the top of the show, if you are a Honey Boba supporter, you too will have the opportunity to help us pick a book club pick every few months for Rira, me, and the rest of the book club to read. But yeah, as of the release of this podcast episode, we have finished our reading schedule on Discord. So if you are a Patreon supporter and have some thoughts about the book, please let us know on Discord so we can include it in our monthly book club discussion next week. And for those of you not on our Discord, you can also let us know your thoughts on our Goodreads forums as well. But yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Kelly Yang for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We've got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.